Get ready to rock radio, music you want to hear.
Hello and welcome to our Anthony Phillips special in our guitarist series here at Get Ready to Rock Radio. And we start off the sequence with a previously unreleased track included on the anthology Harvest of the Heart, released in 2014 by Esoteric Recordings. This features Mike Rutherford, Phil Collins and Anthony Phillips. And it's Silver Song.
Dear friend, when you're gone, there'll always be this song to remind you of where you once belonged. Though far you fly away, your face will bless the day. Each tree, each stream, each flower, all they leave to say, yeah. The sun will shine again, new dawns will rise again, and we'll be together until.
Towards the end of 2014, a fantastic anthology, 5 CDs, 90 tracks, Harvest of the Heart from the original Genesis guitar player Anthony Phillips, and we're adding more of Ant's music into our playlists. I'm speaking now in early March 2015, and we say hello to the man himself. Hello to Anthony Phillips.
Hello, and good afternoon to you. Hello from the south, because I gather I'm talking to the north.
That's it, yes. Mm-hmm. And we're going to catch up on an illustrious career, I have to say. Where do we start? Well, let's go right back and to those glory days, 1970. Just to clear this up, and then we can move on. I'm sure you get asked this all the time.
Don't worry.
And we're going to repeat it here. But when you left Genesis in 1970, it was said that you simply couldn't perform with them on stage. Is that right?
Yeah, it was ironic, really, because I was actually the keenest on going on the road, and I'd been in the one and all the schoolboy bands. Mike Rutherford pretty much with me most of the way, but I was actually even more. Mike would sort of come and go a bit, but I kind of was a real driver of the thing, actually, right the way through from the age of 13. So it was kind of ironic that it was me that was the first one to bail out, because both Peter Gabriel and Tony Banks had to be slightly pushed into it. I mean, Pete found his performing skills later. He wasn't really a natural performer to start with until he kind of assumed roles, and Tony Banks was very shy. So it's kind of ironic that it was, and the others were actually possibly, to start with on the road, a little bit more nervous. Well, I said not all of them. Mike's pretty phlegmatic, but perhaps than I was. Tony was uncomfortable with playing the organ on stage because he was a pianist by heart. That took a lot of things. I was pretty gung-ho, but I don't know. I've always thought it was probably connected with the fact that I had glandular fever not long before we went on the road, which makes you very run down, and I learnt later can actually cause sort of slight nervous system problems. And we lived a pretty rough life, even though we were middle-class boys. And I think all that sort of impacted, and I started getting really sort of chronic stage fright, not nerves, you know, sort of real serious kind of... I've heard since a lot of actors get this... And of course, if I'd known it at the time, it would have been much easier. But it was a pretty unpleasant experience, and so I really had no option but to walk away, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, is that something that stayed with you, or did you get out of that stage fright over the years, or is it something that still affects you?
Well, I've kind of avoided it, to be honest. The truth of it, yeah, it was significant. It was sufficiently unpleasant to have left a pretty. Quite a lot of scars, to be honest. And I mean, I think the truth of it is that over the years, the sort of opportunity of going on the road big time has never really presented itself for all sorts of different reasons. So I haven't really been confronted with a major choice. But I'd still be very wary of it. Yes, I must admit, it was an experience which I think once you've had. I know that there are actors who have worked through this, but I'm not sure really, but we'll see what happens in the future anyway.
Did you ever look back then and regret that Genesis went on to have major success? I mean, you were instrumental in their formation and the early sound of Genesis. I mean, I can come on to say that you then went back to learning your instrument, so to speak, the guitar, and then, of course, the solo career with albums. But how did you feel back in the early 70s? Did you just feel, well, resigned to the fact that you wouldn't be progressing with the band?
Well, I knew I had no choice to leave because there wasn't any use to them in the state I was in. Obviously, it wasn't easy when they started becoming incredibly successful, and I was kind of studying and stuff because I was, you know, so that was difficult. I didn't begrudge it, but obviously, you know, there's a part of you that thinks, oh gosh, well, you know, maybe if I hadn't suffered that way. But I think at the same time, it's worth pointing out, though, that stepping back from the stage fright issues, I do think that you can't have too many composers in one group. And I think it's no coincidence that Peter left in 74, which in the grand scheme of things was actually not a long time after myself. I mean, think how long, you know, the span of the group has been. It seemed like an eternity then. And then Steve leaving in 77. I think you could only have a certain amount of minds. I mean, we all know that many famous songwriting partnerships, duos, end up by having terrible spats and each thinking the other is bringing down his side of the show, right back to Gilbert and Sullivan, let alone Lennon and McCartney later, which all ended in terrible tears. So I think my own feeling is that you get to a point where, you know, you can share some of the cake, but when you're sharing the cake four ways, it becomes a terrible sort of bartering process, and it's often he who has the strongest will who dominates, and they can end up with a lot of dissatisfaction and feeling that you haven't really had your input or whatever. And I think that sort of multi-composing thing is something that it's fantastic when it works, but it's obviously inherently difficult and something that I don't think can last.
Now, is that something you thought at the time, or is that on reflection? Because are you talking now about maybe, you know, even in 1969-70? I mean, maybe after producing two albums, were you getting the feeling then, Ant, that, you know, basically too many cooks in this situation?
Well, I think there were two. I didn't leave because of that. But I think what I'm saying is I think that there would have been, the rift would have come anyway pretty quickly. And by illustrating the others leaving, I think it sort of makes the point pretty well. If you've got too many talented people for too small a share of the cake, I mean, let's face it, look at the groups where you've got terrible personality clashes just over the playing, let alone the composing. And the other important point to make is that, you see, if you're writing in a set structure, verse, chorus, and all the rest of it, somebody can say, well, I don't think your verse is good enough or your chorus isn't good enough. But we were plowing off into all sorts of long instrumental stuff where there was no kind of blueprint to say that's right, that's wrong. And so often it was a question of, as I said, he who had the toughest will, given that everyone was talented, who would dominate. So I think there were a lot of arguments, and I've gathered that after I left there were even more arguments, I think. So I think this is an inevitable part of this multi-composing process. That's what I'm saying. I certainly wasn't thinking at the time, oh, I want to leave because of this. But it is a comment made with the benefit of hindsight.
Your debut album came out, the Geese and the Ghost, that came out in officially 1977.
That's right.
Although I gather it was recorded earlier over a period of time. Now, is this partly because you got involved in some academic education, didn't you? You went to college again.
No. The delays weren't to do with me. My kind of musical education was done piecemeal because I couldn't sight read, so I couldn't get into a music college full time. So there was no sort of fixed period. So I studied part time. I did piano lessons, was taught to read. I studied classical guitar because I was not very, my right hand playing wasn't very good. And studied part-time stuff at the Guildhall, orchestral skills and harmony and counterpoint. I mean, a lot of which was great, some of which I found tedious, inevitably, for somebody who could play by ear and was coming from sort of the other side of the fence. But a lot of that was through by the time I'd been doing that for sort of 3 or 4 years, you see, by the time we came up to the Geese and Ghosts. The major part of which was recorded in 75. No, we fell foul, really. It was a difficult period, really, because Peter left the group, and Mike's attention was inevitably drawn away. He did his best. He was great, but his attention was drawn away to trying to save Genesis, because it's only with the benefit of hindsight that Phil Collins became the singer and stuff. I mean, they were auditioning singers. So the thing was tottering. You know, two of the original four have gone. Can this carry on, as it turned out? Of course it could, because the others are so talented. But again, all with the benefit of hindsight. So I rather kind of lost Mike a bit, and Mike then threw himself into Genesis. And the album sort of kind of drifted onto the shelf, really. And then punk, of course, came along. So it was a deeply unfashionable time. My timing was very peccable. I'm not sure if such a word exists. But anyway, it was peccable because suddenly this kind of stuff was not, the long instrumental, you know, quasi classical stuff was not fashionable. So getting a release for it was pretty difficult. And really nothing happened for about a year. I'd as good as given up on it, to be honest. And I then threw myself back into a lot of teaching, a lot of writing. And in fact, I recorded during the sort of dead period, if you like, 76. I actually recorded a load of stuff that ended up on the first Private Parts of Pieces album.
So
it had a sort of silver lining in a way. But it was picked up belatedly by a US company called Passport, who were a subsidiary of the export company GEM, in late 76. And I was not expecting it by this time. I mean, the album had been completed for a year. a lot of people said to me, well, what's going on here? What's that? This, you know, this sounds fine. I like it. Why is it not out? And I could never really come up with a good answer, really. But, yeah, good old Marty Scott, he saved the day. And then, you know, the rest is history, really.
Yeah. Well, we're going to play now a... just to be different, a demo version of Geese and the Ghosts, which first appeared, as far as I know, on a 1998 archive collection. Just going back then to the 1970s, after you'd left Genesis, I mean, I get this idea, really, that, you know, asking you about whether you regret things, but the way things panned out for you, I mean, it did allow you to go back to, you know, taking up the guitar from in a more academic way. And you could argue, if you'd have been on the road with Genesis, that wouldn't have happened.
I think another point, I think the swings and roundabouts, you can look at this one on both ways. I mean, if you, I'd obviously love to have been part of some of their later music, their later albums, which I admired greatly, and I will always have, not regret, because that sort of sounds that I've made a wrong move. I had no option but to leave, as I said, but it would have been something nice to have been part of all that. But then, on the other hand, I was a pretty narrow musician at the time, who thought that classical music was chaps in sort of stiff shirts listening to Mozart and Beethoven on Sunday morning, I mean, and after church. And the first time, I mean, I'll give you an example, the first time I heard Debussy, Clair de Lune, I thought, my God, this sounds like the Beatles. And I thought, wrong way round. And I suddenly realised that there's a whole treasure chest of stuff out there which I just had been completely closed to by this whole image of, in inverted commas, classical music, which is so unfortunate. And I'm afraid this still permeates today. You know, I have a niece who recently came out with the line, I hate classical music. And I was thinking, well, that's probably just ignorance, actually, because what you're talking about is an unfortunate term given to the best music that has lasted from posterity for the last 1,000 years. Now, if you're telling me that there is nothing amongst that you like, I would challenge you to it. I think people just hear the wrong stuff. It's presented in the wrong way by the wrong people, and youngsters' backs get turned up against it. You see, we were at Charterhouse, we had the same routine. We were told, yes, but that's a lot of noise. One day you'll like serious music. Well, I mean, that's how you, if you want to alienate somebody, that's the way to do it. So I do think it is just bad education. And I was lucky enough to have a sort of road to Damascus experience. And via my first actually the actual Red Damascus was Sibelius's Corellia Suite, which I thought, this is wonderful. It's very melodic. It's you know, it's tuneful. It's exciting. It's rhythmic. It's not at all dry and arid and stiff and all the rest of it. I love this. Well, you know, what's the problem here? So I started delving into sort of lighter classics, things like the Planets and the Variations and stuff, and it was just a mind-boggling experience, as I said, just like opening up this wonderful treasure chest. Now, it's a moot point if I'd stayed in Genesis, if I would have been able to do that. I think I might have been a much narrower musician.
I think, you know, what this is doing, really, Anthony, I mean, this is, you know, the reality is that you're giving some encouragement, actually, indirectly perhaps. The fact you've demonstrated, by your own admission, you weren't sight reading in the late 60s, presumably.
No.
You felt you had more to do, and you went and did it. I mean, I'm jumping forward now because we'll come on to talk about your more recent works.
Yeah.
But if people listen to something like Seventh Heaven, I mean, you've demonstrated it is possible to keep learning your trade, really, and improving, and getting to the state where you're performing with a full concert orchestra.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Indeed. I mean, I'm absolutely right. Although Andrew Skeet did the final orchestrations on that particular CD, I mean, I did quite a lot of the initial sort of basic sketches, and learning to orchestrate, whilst I'm not in his class as a sort of all-rounder, I know what's going on. We can talk the same language, and you know, I understand it all. That's the point. Whereas if you don't and you're working with an arranger, he can pull the wool over your eyes. Well, I mean, not intentionally often, you know. They do their own thing if you don't understand. So I felt getting that knowledge, one of my primary reasons in my then-naive way for wanting to sight read, to learn notation, was to be able to write it. Not just to read it, but so I could have those, those power at my fingertips. You know, after Corelli Suite, I thought I want to be able to know how to do that, and it was a slog. It really was a slog. I found sight reading incredibly difficult because obviously the later you learn it, it is going to be difficult, and I'm still a poor sight reader. But that's not really the point. The point was learning it, so you had access to this. Treasure trove of music, and also, as I said, being able to write it down.
No, I know, yes, and eases communication with somebody like Andrew Skeet, I suppose, as you say.
Get ready to rock, radio!
Now, we're talking to Anthony Phillips, and backtracking on his career, great long career, stretching from the late 60s onwards, really. And if we stay in the 70s, and this is the time that you started making albums for Arista, big label in the late 70s. Now, did you find yourself, or quickly find yourself, compromising your musical direction, if you like, because of the pressure to conform to those label expectations at that time?
I think yes and no. That sounds a ludicrous answer, but it is true. Looking back on it, my direction would have ideally been to take the Geese the Ghost one step further, and we were working on an album based on music around Tark of the Otter, which came out a lot later, but it's worth mentioning because those were sort of two directions. That was with Henry Williamson's son, the author of Tark of the Otter, Harry. And as I was mentioning earlier, with the tide that was blowing in of both very, very simple kind of aggressive music back to the sort of Stones plus, really, in punk, you know, everything had gone into kind of reverse gear, really. We'd gone back about 10 years. Nothing wrong with that, but expecting people like myself to be doing that was obviously ludicrous. And there was also disco as well. So the kind of, you know, the sort of long classical-ish stuff wasn't the time for that at all, in fact. So I like writing songs, so when I was told you've got to do an album of songs, I enjoyed the challenge, but I would say probably, you know, I like to try and turn my hand to all sorts of writing and composing, but I would say that it probably wasn't where I felt most comfortable, if you like, but it was a privilege being able to work with Michael Giles, the drummer, and John Perry, the bassist, on the two Arista albums, which were produced by the delightful Rupert Hine. So, I mean, it had a lot of, although there were some, there were a few spats with the record company where they started to tell me to change my time signature, you know, because people couldn't dance to it. There was one track that had a lot of 7/8, sort of a funny rhythm, and they said make it, put it into the normal time signature. So yeah, I mean, there was an element of sort of a proscription, if you like, from the powers that be, that was difficult, because obviously they were giving me an advance, you know, they wanted to make money, so fair enough in a way. So yeah, there were some tricky angles to it, certainly, but overall, you know, I know that both Wise After the Event and Sides have their devotees, so I can't really regret it too much.
No, and was there any pressure from the record label at that time, and to get out and tour the album?
No, there wasn't really, to be honest. I think that they waited to see what would happen with the initial sales. Initial sales weren't fantastic, and so I mean, given my aversion to it, it didn't really come up, to be honest.
Right.
I mean, I think if we got a sort of a decent-ish bite, people would say, "Yeah, there's a you know, fair wind blowing here. Get out there and tour, and you'll really crack it." But no, that didn't happen actually.
No, we're going to play. You mentioned Sides there, and again, this came out again as a reissue several years ago, and it's an alternative mix of the song Nightmare. We'll be right back. Now, we're in the back end of the 1970s. I mean, when did you think you could get clear, really, from the shackles, what I might call the shackles of the music business, the expectation? You made another album in the early 80s, Invisible Men, which seems to be your last shot at commerciality, really. What were you thinking at this time, Ant? Did you really just want to forge ahead with your own music? And, of course, we must mention here that, of course, you were starting to get involved in library music.
Well, it was a tricky time, really, because after Sides, that the sort of things dried up on the people paying record advances. So anything I did, I had to do at home. That was the big difference people got to remember in those days. If you wanted to record an album of any kind of size, you had to tow record company line in it, and you had to sell. Fair enough, you know, it's a commercial business. So when Sides didn't do the business that they wanted, I was kind of on my own. So I did 1984, the album off my own bat, and actually that was that. Although it was a sort of compromise in a way, I quite enjoyed it. It was rather different in style, instrumental album that was all electronic, very little guitar, but paying lip service to the fashion of the time, which was the rhythm going virtually constantly. And that actually did get picked up by RCA, and we did get an advance for that. But then still the pressure was on very much on the commercial front for songs, and I bought my first house, so suddenly I was mortgaged and inevitably in debt. And so, you know, again, it was towing the line. So it was a new romantics era. So again, let's have an album, songs, you know, poppy. And that was quite fun to start with. But I think the thing is, I think I found difficulty was sustaining interest in stuff like that. It's quite fun writing it and to start with, but didn't have a great deal of depth. And so as one had to go into the sort of, you know, fourth or fifth month of it, trying out overdubs, it started to get really wearing. And it wasn't something I was particularly proud of, even although I know there are people that you know, that do like lots of tracks on it. And then, sorry if I'm jumping ahead, but just to save the trouble of asking, for quite a while, that was the early 80s, that was the last time I did any sort of external album, as it were, on a large canvas for about 7 or 8 years. Albums were simple, and that's when the Private Parts and Pieces series started, of sort of home albums, homespun albums, which were quite simple, either solo guitar pieces, solo piano pieces, or sort of small ensemble pieces, which often made up, I hope, in their sort of vibe, what they lacked in technical presentation. I certainly didn't stop doing albums and stuff because library music was taking off. Library music was very much in its infancy. I mean, I was doing a lot of things. I was songwriting for other people. I was doing some. I did quite a lot of commission for music for Channel 4, for plays for Channel 4, and library music on the side. So everything was sort of pushing along together in the 80s. But it wasn't till the 90s that things started to sort of improve. The 80s was quite a lean time for me, to be honest. I mean, I had to, you know, definitely cut my coat according to my cloth in a number of ways. But actually, you know, there are albums from that time which people still think have merit. So, you know, I don't feel it was time completely wasted.
We're talking about the library music, the music for television and film. Yeah. I thought we'd complete here from Volume 2 of Missing Links, The Sky Road. And you might be interested, Ant, I've picked out the track with Martin Robertson on sax, Tears on a Rainy Day.
Oh, lovely. Thank you.
Anthony Phillips with Martin Robertson on sax and Tears on a Rainy Day. I do like that track. And of course you did collaborate with Martin again and most recently on the Seventh Heaven album. Are there any specific pieces of library music, Ant, that you're particularly proud of?
Oh gosh, that's a difficult one. I don't want to sound as I'm proud of lots. I just don't really think about it very much. I think some of the stuff on Seventh Heaven, which I did with Andrew Skeet, there are one or two tracks on that which I think I am quite proud of, actually, the orchestral tracks. I tend to forget the names, to be honest. And sometimes this original name is then redone on one of my own albums. There's a track which I think they called... there's a track that ended up by being called A Richer Earth, which I'm proud of, on Seventh Heaven, and the one which Lucy Crowe sang, the opera singer, sang called Credo Incantus. I'm quite proud of that. Generally speaking, I'm pretty critical about things. Funny enough, going back to, I must just qualify, when I said, I can't remember what I said earlier, when you said Tears on a Rainy Day, I wasn't, again, trying to say, oh, what a wonderful track. It's just that Tears on a Rainy Day is one of those odd ones that, again, was done as a bit of a sort of improvisation at home, and I got Martin to come and do sax. And it's one that people continue to like very much, and has appeared on virtually every compilation. And it was just one of those odd tracks that seems to, even though the sounds have dated a bit, the mood hasn't dated. It seems to sort of get people. So I'm pleased with that and pleased that you played it. Thank you.
Oh, no, this is it. Well, to be quite honest, it's been a reinvestigation for us putting this feature together and realise it is difficult because listeners, when they investigate all these albums,
yeah.
And there's so many tracks because obviously for film and TV, some of them are quite short as well. They really need to be heard in their entirety, I suppose, that's the thing. But it makes it difficult then to pick out individual tracks. But hopefully we've given a flavour, I think, in those three pieces.
Well, it's very kind of you. I must just point out one drawback sometimes with library pieces. Just explain to the audience,
yes,
who don't
yes.
know, listeners, I mean, that the discipline is often doing a track which can be quite short. They don't want things over 3 minutes. So, and you do also have to, you can't suddenly veer off in a leftwards direction. You've got to stay, you can do a variation, but you've got to stay, you're setting up one atmosphere, one mood with slight variations, and you can't suddenly go diving off. So great development isn't going to be possible within these tracks. And I know that people on Seventh Heaven said, I'd love some of this, but the tracks are too short. And well, yeah, I mean, no, that's good. That sort of went with the territory, really. So that is, in some respects, the drawback of releasing those on commercial albums, which is they do perhaps have, therefore, slightly the stature of a miniature as opposed to a sort of a, you know, a magnum opus. But I've always tried to be very careful and select ones that I think do stand up rather than just putting on stuff, because, you know, I've done the best part of 1,000 library tracks, so probably only about 70, 80, 90, 100 top whack have ever been released. So we do try and choose quite carefully.
Yeah, I suppose you're perhaps looking for tracks which complement each other.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, they've got to stand on their own merit away from a picture. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Well.
So that's, you've already said then something, Ant, that I didn't realise. But are you saying then that some of the pieces on the most recent Seventh Heaven album originated as library music?
Most of it did.
Ah.
Ah, most of it did. That's why the tracks are so short.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, most of it was from an orchestral CD that was recorded in Prague to start with, and then a lot of it was redone. At Abbey, some of it was redone at Abbey Road. A few of the tracks weren't, but most of it was, yeah. So I'm pleased that you said that, because it's obviously not obvious, which is good.
Well, there you go. And I think they do, well, that says it, doesn't it? They hang together nicely, and yeah, interesting,
right.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
Now, 1990, you'd signed with Virgin,
and
released a slightly more commercial album after a sort of absence of maybe 5 or 6 years, really. Slow Dance. I hate to call it your Tubular Bells, but it was stretched over two sides of vinyl at the time. And In spite of the label reissuing some of your earlier albums, you didn't make any more new albums for them, as far as I remember. What happened?
The only ones I did within the Virgin contract were Slow Dance, which in fact I'd done before I signed with them, and Private Parts and Pieces 8 was the one that I did do within the contract. But you see, what happened was that EMI took over Virgin quite quickly after I joined. And I was in the sort of alternative, it doesn't mean it was, you know, lots of weird crash bang and wallet stuff, but I was in the kind of, it wasn't called progressive actually, but it was just in the also alternative department where people who had a sort of a small devout following of fans, their catalogues would be released and would make money, but they wouldn't make pots of money. Unfortunately, when the catalogue went over to EMI, the accountants looked and they were looking for monster figures. So anybody that wasn't making monster figures was out. So unfortunately, I got my cards along with a lot of other people, and that whole department was decimated. So all very sad times. But Slow Dance had in fact been recorded just before that. Slow Dance had been recorded in 1988-89, and you're right to call it the Tubular Bells, I don't mean in terms of the comparison of the standard of it, but in terms of the amount of effort and time. Apart from the Geese and the Ghosts, that's the one on which I sweated most blood. I took an enormous amount of time and painstaking detail to such a point where I finished it, I could not physically listen to it. It was just pain, the pain of listening to it, because if you get too close to something, as you know, it all starts to look or sound terrible, and I couldn't judge it at all.
And with the benefit now of some distance and hindsight, how do you view Slow Dance? I mean, I presume you can listen to it now.
Well, I think I'm influenced by what other people say, of course, as well. I don't have a great deal of confidence. So if people tell me it's rubbish, I think, well, okay, you're probably right. And if they tell me it's wonderful, even if it's terrible, I tend to go along with it. No, I'm joking up to a point. But enough people have said they like that to have... not convince me, but I always talk about with library music, and the same thing with a lot of other stuff is that we have I talk about a 2-year rule, which is don't listen to it for 2 years, and in 2 years time you'll have forgotten what was wrong with it, it'll sound fine. But you can get so obsessed with the things that aren't right, the things you've got a mystical idea in your head how something could sound, and you never get it. And of course it's a good thing you never get it, because otherwise you'd sit back and think, aren't I clever. I think the fact that you're frustrated drives you, well, this is my only thing entirely, to drive you on to try and keep going and produce something that is better.
A single edit version of Slow Dance, appearing on the 1998 compilation The Archive Collection. We're going to round things off, bringing things full circle with your recent album. It's classically based with Andrew Skeet. We've already talked about it. We're going to play the track called Under the Infinite Sky to give listeners a flavour of what I think is a marvellous. I've only just acquired this just before the interview. And I mean, knowing that you you play classical so well and knowing all the background and everything, this still comes out as a bit of a revelation, really, because it's a lovely, easy listen and very nicely produced with full orchestra. An album that any artist would be proud of, actually. And I think, really, it's almost the album you've been working up to since 1969.
Well, I was very happy. I was very happy with it. I mean, I think it probably baffled a few people, but I think the thing about Under the Infinite Sky, it's, you know, I mean, I'm in my big comfort zone with 12-string, and Andrew wrote these great string parts on top, and people can, you know, there is the tendency to grimace with this, isn't there? You think, oh my God, strings on top. It's such a cliche for rock musicians, but actually, hopefully, because of our understanding, what he's done on top is a marriage rather than a kind of, you know, a slightly uncomfortable superimposition.
Yeah, well, we'll hear this track. And is there any one album, you know, it's very difficult, I know, to pick out albums, but if you were going to direct a new listener to your body of work, Ant, would you recommend any particular album?
Oh dear, that's awfully difficult. Well, what was interesting, Andrew Skeet came over recently and heard, I think he knew the album, but he heard The Geese and the Ghosts in 5.1, and he said it sounds very contemporary, which, and people, and God, if I saw her now, the song on that, one of the songs on that, which Phil Collins sings, seems to have managed to jump generations. A lot of people in the 20s and 30s are saying, what a lovely song, which I'm finding quite strange, really. So I think that hasn't dated as much as I thought it might do, so I'm delighted to point people in that direction. Slow Dance is a bit of a favourite because it's so romantic and lyrical, and that seems to move people, definitely. That seems to sort of cut through certain things. I'm fond of Seventh Heaven, but it may be a little bit too... the tracks may be a bit too short and it may be too orchestral for some people, but I'd go between those three, perhaps Private Parts and Pieces 1. Oh gosh, I don't know, really.
Yes, anyway. Well, they'll get into that for the, you know, there's no stopping them then, is it? They'll be off. Well, look, it's been really great talking to you. We should ask you finally, what have you got planned for the future, certainly in 2015? Any immediate plans?
Well, I'm very much involved in the re-release stuff. Obviously, they're going to come thick and fast, and so I'm going to have to be supervising this and looking for extra tracks, getting them remastered and all the rest of it. And I'm very much involved with the whole library music scene as well, so sort of juggling those two and the ever-increasing technical demands in the studios, it gets ever more complicated to understand it all as they get older. So those are quite sufficient demands. I mean, I'm trying to, a number of people are saying, when's the new album coming? And I'm thinking, well, guys, I seem to be trying to do too many different things and my head's going to explode. So I'm hoping to be able to do a new album at some stage, but we'll have to see. There's nothing definite. There's a lot of bits, a lot of ideas, but nothing definite at the moment.
No, it seems that this may be the year for you to consolidate, really. You've got projects on the go with the reissues and, as you say, enough to keep you well occupied. We thank you, Ant Phillips, for a really interesting hour of chat and, you know, illuminating your past, really. And I hope listeners do go out and start investigating, maybe from that suggestion that you gave, Geese and the Ghosts, and also, of course, not forgetting Seventh Heaven. So we'll leave the listeners with Under the Infinite Sky. Thanks to you, Anthony Phillips.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you.
Thank you.